It is time for us to begin this morning, so you'll want to open up your Bibles to the book of Acts in the 23rd chapter, Acts chapter 23. We'll be reading and considering and reflecting upon the text in just a moment. Before we get into our study this morning, if you would bow with me in prayer. This is Acts chapter 23 for class this morning, and let's go ahead and we'll wait just one more second. A little safer that way. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the time we share in reflection and study. We thank you for the blessing that we are finding in Christ and the wonderful nature of the kingdom of your Son. Help us as students today to listen well, to ask good questions of ourselves, to pay attention to the message left for us, and to grow our faith. This is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so we've got a lot of stuff that we can kind of pay attention to today. We're looking at the series of many trials, like small trials that Paul goes through in this latter part of his life. In particular today, we're going to make note of how they match or line up to the sequence in the trials of Jesus as he went before various authorities. Then there's some literary connections that I would suggest are valuable enough to pay attention to that might help at least on two levels. One, to remember things. That's primarily for me, at least, when I see these literary repeats, they help for memory. I can remember it better if I know it's tied to another story, and I could kind of latch it in my brain and say that story is like this story, and so now I remember both of them better. But also, at times, you can tell that these are crafted in a way to make us think of the prior story or to make us think of the current story in a connected way. So we'll pay attention to that, too. Remember, this is a culmination of events taking place here, where by inspiration, Paul had already been told that this, to a certain degree, was going to be his future, in that he would be carried in chains, that he would go through some level of a crucible like this, that he would do so going through Jerusalem and potentially a picture of Rome is on the table as well. And we know that the disciples, at times, had two different opinions about it. Some disciples brought him this knowledge. Others, with the revelation of this reality, were trying, at times, to convince Paul to avoid it. By the time he got to Jerusalem, the tables had been set up for the opportunities in the future. And Paul is willingly engaging in public activity with a first layer goal to reconcile Jews and disciples of Jesus in the community there in Jerusalem. Surrounding that, you had civil unrest. We've identified them, and in context, they are referred to in the original language as the Sicarii. We would probably say they are basically terrorists seeking to overthrow Rome as the ruling authority and return it to what they believe would have been legitimate Israelite rule. And so that's going around in the middle of all of this. And so we get to the end of Paul's 7-day fast. He is arrested or brought into custody for protection. Both of those statements are true. And he's already had his defense there in the temple that did not go like it would have been wanted by various parties. But now he is going to move from the temple guard space, which is the Adonai fortress there is that location, to where he's going to meet with the Sanhedrin. And so that's going to be taking place in the very beginning part of chapter 23. Some things to note topographically to kind of contextualize this. there are three possible locations for what would be taking place next for Paul in this area. And it's very common for governmental buildings to also be residences, and there's sites around the temple that say, well, maybe this may have been the place. And so these are things that we're recognizing, and they intersect what is called the Via Dolorosa, which is the route that Jesus likely could have taken throughout his trial, crucifixion, and eventual death and then resurrection. And so these are all layered over the top of each other. Same community, same people in some of these instances, same physical locations. And so kind of keep in the back of your mind that Paul is walking the same ground that Jesus would have walked through part of his own experiences. And so that should change the mood. It should be more somber in some ways to a degree. Let's start, though, by reading together. And maybe I'll get a voluntold. I'll voluntold Norris, if you will, to read for us. And so, Norris, could you read just the first 10 verses of chapter 23? That's for our reading today.
Chapter
23, verses 1 through 10.
Then Paul looked earnestly at the council and said, "Men and brothers, I have lived in all of good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, 'God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law. And do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?' And those who stood by said, 'Do you revile God, high priest?' Then Paul said, 'I do not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler or your people.' But when Paul perceived that one part of the Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead. I am being judged.' And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees profess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisee party rose to protect and protest, saying, 'We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God.' Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down to take him by force from among them and bring him to the barracks.
Let's pause for a second and play a little word game. You guys probably used to do this when you were in school years ago. And you know, the teacher would get on the wall and the whiteboard and say, "Hey, what did you notice in those 10 verses? Anything interesting?" And they just start throwing it out on the wall. So anything come at you surprising, or things that you're reading through this time you hadn't paid attention to before? Bits and pieces that might be important to you? By the way, I do this all the time. When I'm reading through something, I stop, I get my little notepad out, and I didn't notice that before. Or that seems interesting. And so you get to join in me in the process I use to kind of read through the text. What's interesting? I'll give you one that was really interesting to me that I noticed a couple years ago that now I always make note of when I read it now, is that Paul did not know who the high priest was. It says it very explicitly, but it's easy to kind of walk over it and go. But that helps us kind of frame one key detail. From the time that Paul left Judaism and left his involvement with the Sanhedrin, because these are the same people who had given him letters, there's been enough turnover that they don't know each other, at least in the leadership capacity. He doesn't know that this guy is the high priest. We don't even know how he knows that there are Pharisees and Sadducees present. Because he just says, he knows. He discerned that. Well, that's two things that are kind of interesting. What else? Anything else jump out at you as a careful, small detail?
Well,
Rich?
The high priest didn't like the way that Paul was looking at him.
Oh, yeah. There's a sense in the way that Luke records this for us, where it's Paul's gaze is earnest. Multiple translations use that phrase, where he is intent with a sense of genuineness. High priest, on the other hand, says, I don't like the way you're looking at me. There's a sense of the opposite response for the high priest. Bobby?
Isn't the high priest just different from the rest of the priests?
In ceremonial context, absolutely. There would have been difference in attire when they were offering sacrifices. That was not a permanent clothing mandate, though. It was when they go to do their work. And so we have to understand that there is a limitation on Paul's ability to determine who's who. Now, there's two reasons for that. I've already given one, right? That is, he just doesn't know who it is. What's another reason Paul may not be able to figure out who's who?
If they change the high priest, they would choose who they want to be high priest.
Right. And Bobby said that part of it. Maybe they don't have an indication. But remember, how does Paul have to sign his letters sometimes? See how large it is. I'll give you a secondary clue as to what might also be going on. So what do you think is a problem for Paul and why he can't figure out who the high priest is? As far as we can read in the text, Paul can't see very well. That's why that terminology is used. That's why he says, hey, see with what large, I signed this in my own hand. Someone else wrote this. I'm signing it. Even though Paul, earlier in life, wanted books brought to him. So there's some aspects, plus his hard life, beaten, shipwrecked. His physical body is kind of moving towards its end of things. You wouldn't say Paul's blind, because his sight had been restored to him from the road. So he was blinded, but then he wasn't. But he doesn't have great vision. So you have a change of priest, inability to identify it, and his own physical limitations, and doesn't know that. That also changes one more detail. It seems that nobody in the Sanhedrin knows Paul or is willing to admit that they know Paul. I think that's important. Like, it's either of those possibilities. And there's some other texts that talk about it. Even some folks that would suggest that Paul's thorn in his side might have been related to his vision as well. But that kind of gives us some, at least initial layering, to say, hey, look, this is what's going on. Paul says some pretty harsh things, though, to this high priest. Norris? He's pretty straight with that. And then he gets pushed back from the high priest. Paul acknowledges, I really shouldn't speak evil of the high priest. Is he saying it was okay to say that if he wasn't the high priest? Like, well, that's a complicated thing there, right? What he said kind of true, but kind of not true at the same time? Like, there's some troubles there. Norris, you first, and then Rich.
To me, when he said that he had lived in all good conscience before God until his day, that he had, it seemed like to me he had that confidence that he didn't care who the high priest was, that he felt like he said what he needed to say regardless of who the high priest seemed like to me.
Yeah, we're going to get to this comment here in a second as to why that would be offensive, that conscious comment there in a second. Rich?
So I think that through the examples we've seen through Paul, I think he's a very good person who can read the room. In this particular case, somebody he didn't know, but then he falls back on their own laws, right? And so he knows the law, and so he's able to, I would say, what would you say, stand his ground. So he can stand his ground, however, still being respectful, but he still can read the room as to what's his next step.
Yeah. Remember, Paul's inspiration and perspiration takes place in all contexts. So God has insight for him. but Paul is chosen for this task because of who Paul is. So there's a little bit of both going on. So here's some things to think about. Considering the text of Job as our literary backdrop and the way in which Job's friends thought about Job's calamities, what was the consensus of their theological reasoning as to why his life was awful? Because he had sinned. Clearly, his problems were due to his sin. And then what does the text of Job try to get us to accept as if there's another factor than just a man's sin that can create chaos? What's that other factor? In the text, it's the devil, right? It's the unseen realm that a man could do, be seeking God with all of his heart, acknowledge that he is trying to do so and is mostly successful, and Job's arrogance is a little bit in the text, but also the ignorance of his friends is in the text, because it was not at all because of his sin. It was because of an entirely different thing that we don't know. Partially because of the dialogue between the devil, Satan, Satan, and God, but partially because of our ignorance as to why these things actually started. So when Paul makes this statement, I have a clear conscience before you, it's still in a backdrop in a world that still acts as Job's friends. Well, you wouldn't be here if you had a clear conscience. You wouldn't be arrested. And you'd still be doing the thing we told you to do, which was to go out and persecute those of the way. That's part of it. Also, consider the trial of Jesus. And who is getting blamed directly for the crucifixion of the Christ? In the preaching of the disciples on Pentecost, who was the blame? The Jews who were present. We got to be really precise with that. It was not all Jews all time everywhere. It was you crucified him, you who were present today listening to that preaching. Which would have, by at least implication, included the high priest, the Sanhedrin people. Like, they would have been part of that herd because they were doing these same things. And I'm going to go ahead and put this up there. We'll talk about this later, but you can begin to kind of see these sequences lay out. And so don't get distracted. You guys start staring at this too much. That's it. Mm-mm. You guys are not paying. You guys are too sucked into all the words. All the wait for. It's like a surprise tease. But begin to see these series of things lay themselves out where some of the statements that Paul makes are hinting back towards commonly known entities of the trial of the Christ, the resurrection, the turmoil afterwards, the preaching of the apostles in Jerusalem, Paul's own work outside of Jerusalem. These are all kind of bubbling on the surface. And then, here in this text, there's a nice little interplay. Jesus is struck and stays silent. Paul is struck and speaks out. And he uses a metaphor, a whitewashed wall, that comes from Ezekiel 13. In that text, this is the subtle dig that you may not get outside of the culture. In that text right there, it's God denouncing a false prophet for misleading the people with comforting announcements of peace at a time when there is no peace. And so we know in our own language and culture, when somebody makes a statement that actually stings a little bit deeper, where someone outside of our culture doesn't even begin to understand that that thing is a thing. I'll use this illustration from my childhood. You know, if someone, let's see if you guys know this. If a coach told you that they had seen better hands on a digital clock, what are they trying to tell you? Yeah, that means you can't catch the ball, right? You got better hands on a digital clock, Martin. Get there, run that route again, all right? But if you don't know what a digital clock is, and you don't know it's an athletic metaphor for catching a ball or a football, then it just sounds weird. Well, that's kind of what we need to see here with this whitewashed wall. And there's a secondary throwback to Jesus himself describing whitewashed tombs, because there's similar word plays being employed there. So Paul's comment is what we would say incendiary. Like it's like, okay, you're the problem. So that kind of helps us kind of understand. Now, remember, Luke is giving us a synopsis at times, not an inch-by-inch dialogue. So we don't know what everyone else is saying. So some other things go on, and Paul is able to ascertain that this Sanhedrin is divided upon theological premises. And he makes the statement, I am on trial for the resurrection of the dead. And he really kind of appeals to their party problem. This was already a problem. Remember Jesus dealt with this in the first century? Well, whose wife is he? You know, they had this whole series, is she like, boom, 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 who is the, like, what's going on? Because they were trying to say, there's no resurrection, was their argument, and this is how they had proven it. By the way, as a side note, just every time you see a human going to God with some scenario to try to figure out things, realize that the problem is the man who's made up the scenario. Scenarios never match reality. They don't actually prove anything. They're just invented to create complications. It's always best to deal with the actual reality of a circumstance. That's the only way you're going to figure things out. So his big argument here is, look, it's about the resurrection of the dead. Is that fair?
Yes.
Yeah, it's an accurate thing, because in a practicality, it is only because of the resurrection of the dead that he listened and heard his Lord. So now let's think about Paul the Pharisee for a second. Because he's looking at him earnestly. He's talking to them as best he could as one of them, because he is. And Pharisees really kind of held to this concept. And so that should help us understand how easy it was for Paul to accept the risen Lord. He already believed in resurrection. Now it was manifested for him in a full manner. And so it actually closed in the loop of his understanding rather than shattering everything. It really kind of helps us perhaps begin to picture this in a little bit more whole way. All right, now you get the whole chart. We'll put that up there. A lot of information up there just for citation purposes. But basically, we can kind of see some structural similarities between how Luke tells us of the trial of Christ and how Paul's trial is gone over by Luke as well. It makes sense that the similarities, you have the same inspired writer working, right? He's going to use the same templates to describe things. But there are some things that happen in that trial that on a narrative level are important. You see the similarity of a journey that goes, similarity of the mob that comes in, the Sanhedrin, and then royal authorities, Pilate, Herod, Pilate, Felix, Festus, Herod. And then you have that striking we just talked about before, where Luke records that Jesus is struck and responds with silence. Paul is struck and responds with a caustic, incendiary remark. Three declarations of innocence take place in the text. And eventually you have the connections of the crowd. Away with this man. You'll solve this in the way we've always solved these things. Did the crucifixion of Jesus solve their problem? The oddity of the oddity is it could have. They made their own problem, and had they accepted the consequences of it and rejoiced at the resurrection through it, it would have. But they, like the insane man are believing that if they just keep doing the same thing over and over again, they'll get different results. Somebody who is a prophet comes and tells us things we don't want to hear, we'll just kill them. Which is echoed through the prophets. And actually, its last echo and the refrain of that is found in the text of Revelation, where the blood of the prophets is said to be an avenger from the streets of Jerusalem to judge. So there is a lot going on there. But there are at least three things I think we can identify underneath it that are important. Number one, we can recognize that in this text there is the image of a righteous heart in both of these stories that behave differently. The Bible never presents Paul's behavior as sin in this trial. And so you can respond to accusations. It's always a challenge to do so, right? Figure out what to say when someone makes an accusation about your faith, what you believe. And I saw this note about 2 days ago. I was kind of reading through some things, and for the most part, Jesus' response to questions was to universally do what? There's really two options that Jesus uses when he's asked questions in public, large crowds.
He responds with questions.
Most of the time, it's, let me ask you a question. Like, that's something only that a lawgiver can do. I think there's a little bit of level that we have to realize that while answering a question with a question has its place, it shouldn't be our only response, because Jesus also has a second response to questions. Just doesn't even answer them. Not every question needs to be answered. Years ago, I think is when I first saw this little picture. They had a picture of a guy late at night on his computer. And he's typing away, and his wife comes up to him in the next comedic frame. And the wife goes, "Hey, what are you doing? I found people wrong on the internet. I need to tell them." You know, not everyone needs to know that they're wrong or that you think they're wrong. Like, maybe it's just okay to let them be and realize that nothing you say is going to change your opinion of, or their opinion of you or the subject. And it's okay just to say, that's not mine. I can't answer that. I don't need to. But Paul then presents the third option, where there are times when a bold and clear response is actually what needs to happen. Because now let's think inwardly for ourselves. If no one ever comes to you and says, quoting from the prophets, "Thou art the man," it's possible that some of your sins lay on the table. Now, that conversation won't always look like it is for David and the prophet. Right? You don't always set him up with a story about sheep. Because pretty much any of us who have raised children have had the conversation that goes something more like this. "You know, there used to be 5 cookies in this cookie jar, but now there's only 2. Do you know who ate these cookies?" Every parent has a conversation like that at some point with their kids. Because you're trying to get them to confess rather than just come out and say it. And if you're like my kids in my household, the answer generally became, "Dad must have eaten those." And sometimes that was accurate. Sometimes that was an accurate response to the death of the cookies. That's the same thing. You're asking a question, but you're trying to get them to confess to the problem. But sometimes you don't do that. This is your mess. You made this. You're the man. And you skip the story and you get right to the facts. And Paul skipped the story because of the nature of the problem. There was no justification for him to be struck. And no, Paul didn't strike him back. Paul, as a prophet of God, came back and condemned him for his behavior. "That you then will be struck." And there's some indication in the text of Revelation that you might want to connect that A plus B equals C in this case, that there was a striking back by God's side that was already foretold by Jesus. And so you can kind of link these things together to a degree. Secondly, in the text right here, is we need to acknowledge, and we kind of seen this already, the centrality of his defense from the temple, last chapter, to the palace in Rome is going to be the resurrection. It is going to be his conviction on the hope of the resurrection that he makes all of his commentary, whether he is speaking to someone and saying almost, the guy comes, almost you're almost persuaded to be a Christian too, Paul, he still talks about the hope of the resurrection. This is, by the way, why I believe, and next Sunday we're going to talk about it in our worship together, the resurrection in particular, that the resurrection is the most significant apologetic for Christianity, period. All the archaeological stuff is great, all your textual reasoning is great, but in the end it is the resurrection of the Christ that is central to everything. Paul does it in his defense, I encourage others to do it in theirs, and I do it in mine. And if you want to tie it together in the text of Peter's writings, to be set for the defense of the gospel is to explain the hope that's within you. And the hope is only there because of the risen Christ. And so there's a centralness to that reality that all of us need to pay attention to. And if you didn't notice it, Paul is indicating with clarity that Jesus' resurrection was a bodily resurrection. That's an important thing, because in the first century and in our century, people still struggle to figure that stuff out. And they at times develop theories and positions residing in the Bible that don't match what Jesus did and what the disciples said, that he was physical when he was raised. And that we too will be, to whatever degree that means, physical as well. And so those are things we kind of have to pay attention to. So that's me talking for a little bit. I've got a little bit more down on the table. But what's your observations here? Have you ever seen this before? Is this new or a repeat? So shake it, you know, is this new? Raise your hand. You've seen this before. Is this like brand new? Have you heard of it before? That's when you can raise your hand. Right? So this is something important, and there's two reasons why I think it's valuable, like I talked before. One, it helps you remember. Now it's a memory tool. But also, remember, there is obvious theological, or two passages next to each other. Theology is just having one passage and then another passage and talking about how they connect. Well, that's theology right there. You have two passages talking about two individuals doing, in this case, very similar things. So you pay attention to whether they're the same, but also when they're different. And you start to ponder and think about, why are they different? Well, there's two things going on, and you can kind of catch that. Remember, though, Jesus had often foretold that the manner of death of some would be like his. And Paul had routinely been told that his demise would have some similarities to his Lord. And so that kind of hints us in there. And then there's a third one that's pretty obvious, the same writer. You know, Luke's writing about this by inspiration and perspiration, so it kind of makes sense that he would structure it in a way that kind of repeats. So any thoughts about this? Anything that is it, before I kind of move on, we'll leave this up here for a few seconds. We've got about 5 minutes of one more thing to talk about.
A couple things. When you think of Jesus' trial, I mean, that's like within 24 hours.
Yeah.
Versus Paul's over a couple days, right? So just kind of going through that a little bit, I think it's very interesting. And just one other thing. Last week we talked about what's the timeline between when Paul was converted to now. We're talking somewhere between 7 and 15 years.
Yeah.
So it's quite likely that a lot of these people who were on the Sanhedrin were there when they condemned Christ as well. So I think that's interesting to me because they're basically doing the same thing they did.
Yeah, they would have been alive in the culture of Israel during the condemnation of Christ. Obviously, we have a new high priest. None of them seem to know Paul in a way that they're willing to confess him. And we know some of the leaders who were there involving Christ had jumped ship and join the disciples. We know that some Pharisees, some Sadducees, some zealots, and some from the ruling council had come to consider Christ their king and their Messiah. So that crowd that would have been most likely to know Paul from his earlier parts of his life is now in a different space. So all of these things then should serve as a way for us to really think, again, don't also forget, a side note, these are all on the same dirt paths. You know, you can walk to all of these locations in a day by yourself. Even today, with buildings in the way, you can just still go from spot to spot to spot to hit all of them in one day, no problem. On your feet, and you can get all these same locations. Where this is likely happening, from the fortress where he is captured to the location, likely possibilities for the Sanhedrin, to the very place where Jesus was crucified and the place where he was buried, is under a mile in distance. You know, so we're not talking about huge spaces of ground. There's a text that Paul writes in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 9, which is one of my favorite small sentences from the epistles. It's entitled, includes this phrase, "My strength is made perfect in weakness." It's in the section where Paul's explaining how he had called for the Lord to alleviate this thorn in the flesh from his life. Now remember, the Paul who calls for this is zealous in service, has engaged in what we would consider the work of miraculous activities of various kinds, has matured his faith, and is convicted that he would be more effective, or at least the pain of whatever it was would be removed if this problem were healed. Now remember, not only Jesus, but the disciples had reached points in their ministry where people were being healed. And so Paul's, whatever it was, being removed is a sensible possibility. It's like not out of the realm of God can do, because God was doing. And yet, his response is, no, you need that. It needs to stay. Whatever it was, whatever your individual conclusions about that thorn, was necessary for Paul to train whom he is. And I think there's some value there for us to think about, because it's very likely in the same context that these ideas are going to be playing out for Paul. If you accept my kind of conclusion that has something to do with his vision, his ability to see as part of this problem, it does affect this encounter. Paul can't figure out who's who. He's blind to some degree in some contexts. And it is a weakness, as all of us can kind of understand. It limits our abilities to various degrees. And so in this case, I would suggest that that perceived weakness lives underneath the true strength of Paul. And it's not his physical prowess. He doesn't fight back with his arms. He doesn't receive that strike and say, "I'm going to knock you out." He condemns him on a spiritual level, because that's the level that Paul was living in. But never resist the Roman authorities nor the Jewish authorities in his captivity. Even though, has he already seen that God will break him out of prison? Chains don't bind him. They're not the things that keep him where he is. Even later, he will say, "I would wish that all were like me except for these chains." And yet he never uses his relationship with God to have the chains removed. I think there is something inside of that that we have to kind of figure out, that we can be weak and strong at the same time. And that our strength isn't always demonstrated by physical prowess. Sometimes it's simply by our speech. Because he spoke pretty fiercely. We would say boldly. And I already said it was very incendiary because of the words that he used. But Paul also accepted the consequences of his speech too. And there was an outcome to that. And I think there's probably something in our own spiritual development that we need to glean from that in very practical ways. There are times that, yeah, maybe we don't respond with physical things, but we do make our point clear and precise and maybe even cut to the bone in ways that are uncomfortable. Knowing that when it's the other way around, when it's someone speaking to us, we don't like it. As is often the case, the clock is telling us what to do, and I'll go ahead and scoot to the final question space. And so, what's your observations here, both of our overview of the text, or things that you liked or didn't like, or things that, as you were reading and studying this week, you thought were important for you or for us? Les?
When difficult things happen in our life, it's a test of our faith, and when we come out of it in the right direction, then our faith is made stronger.
Yeah.
Just as Paul was made stronger through the difficult life of Christ, told him he would suffer for his name,
yeah.
And he was made strong through that.
And the outcome of this is the continued or ongoing transformation of Paul, which is powerful because he's the one who wrote that text. Paul is still being matured in these experiences. What else? Anything in here you were surprised by or didn't like or didn't know or understand? I still have a lot trying to figure out exactly what Paul knows and doesn't know about each of these steps for him. And I say that in light of his apparent high level of confidence. Because for me, the more I know what's going to happen, the more confident I am about things. Like, I know how a car responds, I can drive that car. When I first started driving in cars, I didn't know how they were going to respond. I know how tools work, so I can use them with confidence. When I first started using them, I didn't know what I was going to do. Paul seems to know or behave as one who knows the outcome in ways that I can't see. Bobby?
I've never seen anywhere in the Bible commanded to be smitten in the Bible.
Yeah, there's two sets of laws for Israel. There is the law written in the scriptures, and then they had the rabbinical law underneath that. That would be the practices of the Pharisees, the writings of the Mishnahs, and various of the documents. And I'm going to suggest that it's both of those they're saying is the standard and method that they're using. That's it for our time for class this morning. And so we'll continue moving forward in the text next Sunday as we work our way with Paul towards Rome. Thanks, everybody.